Y'all quieted right down. Is everyone having an amazing morning? Are we off to a good start? Okay, I am Christina Lucconi. I'm the Chief People Officer at Rapid7. I'm also feeling incredibly short. Rapid7, we are a locally headquartered company, now with about 1,000 people strong globally. And we're really fortunate in that we've spent years supporting the Mass Women's Conference, and this year was the first year we've been large enough and had enough money to be able to actually present as a sponsor this year. So I'm really proud of our company and the 50-plus women that we have coming to the conference today, and welcome you all here. I am incredibly excited to introduce our two speakers. Adam, how many of you all saw Adam speak this morning in the keynote? Pretty amazing, right? So I won't go through his whole bio, which I'm sure you all read and you got a chance to hear and learn a little bit about him. But the interesting thing that I just learned, and I will admit I'm quite a fangirl and have read all this stuff and love it, he and Celeste Ng, who is our other speaker today, are college friends. So they both attended Harvard and they both attended University of Michigan, and here they are together and are going to do sort of a fireside chat for you and ask each other a whole bunch of questions, and hopefully it will feel incredibly authentic and engaging. So would you all please join me in giving a warm welcome to Adam Grant and Celeste Ng.
Thank you all so much for inviting us here. I know that many of you just heard Adam's talk this morning, and so we're going to try and talk about some other things that maybe he didn't get a chance to talk about in his keynote address. So I'm Celeste Ng. I live here in Cambridge, and as you all just learned, Adam and I actually are very old friends. We went to college together. How do we know each other?
We worked at the Let's Go
That's
Travel
right.
Guides
we
together.
We worked editing Let's Go Travel Guides together, which is a thing where we send college students out to research and write travel guides, and we got to stay at home in Cambridge and support them.
Although the company sort of imploded after we left, so
clearly,
I'm a little worried about our management.
I was going to say the opposite, which is that clearly it's because we're no longer there.
Oh, yeah.
And then we re-met again when we were at the University of Michigan. I was getting a Master of Fine Arts, and Adam was finishing his PhD. So it's really a pleasure to get to be here and talk with you, Adam.
I'm thrilled to do this, and I just have to say it's been so fun to watch your career take off.
Well, and likewise. So we actually haven't seen each other in a decade, I think. We just saw each other again from over there. So the first thing I guess I want to ask you about, Adam, which is something we were talking about, is that we're here at the Women's Conference, and we were looking for Adam when we came into the room, and I said, well, he should be pretty easy to spot because he'll be the man. And so I'm just curious how it feels being one of the men. I mean, you don't even get to go into the bathroom. The ladies, the men's rooms have been converted into ladies' rooms for the conference, and so you have to, you know, go all the way over to the one men's room. But this isn't your first time being here. You've been here before, right?
Yeah, I think it's changed a little bit over time. I think the first time I came here 2 years ago, I got a very immediate dose of what it feels like to be a token. And, you know, I think it's something everyone should go through, right? I've very rarely walked into rooms at any point in my life and, you know, been the only man or the only white person. And it really does shift your perspective, and it drives home what it feels like to be an outsider. I'll say, though, that what's more salient now is that audiences of women are just way more fun to speak to than audiences of men. Men tend not to laugh or clap or cheer, and women are much more comfortable expressing emotion. So I was just at an event that was almost all men the day before yesterday, and I spoke, and they're all stoic and being like, What else are you going to say? Impress me. And I find audiences of women much more entertaining and enjoyable, so...
And so that kind of feeds into one of the topics that I was hoping to ask you about, which is sort of this idea of expressing sort of the difficulties that you have of being able to be upfront about that, and also of you know, not trying to pretend like you've got it all together when sometimes things are really going wrong.
How do we get better at doing that? How do we get better at talking about adversity, because we all face it in big ways, in small ways? How do we get better about, you know, being okay showing when we're vulnerable sometimes?
The irony of asking me that question is not lost on me. I think the first thing I would say is I think that really often we stay silent just because we're afraid of saying the wrong thing. And we don't want to make other people uncomfortable. And we forget that sometimes silence is the easiest way to make people uncomfortable. And so I think that, you know, I had a mentor actually in grad school who said the most helpful thing he was ever told. He's a psychologist. He'd worked a lot with couples. And he said the best advice he ever got was from his wife. He said, when I bring up a problem, what I'm looking for is sympathy, not solutions. And his instinct was, every time there's a problem, okay, I'm going to solve it. I need to fix it. And this may be sort of a stereotypically male instinct. But I think a lot of people feel that pressure, right? When you see someone who's hurting, what you want to do is you want to help.
I remember that ages ago you sent me a video from the internet where there was a woman. Do you know what I'm going to talk about? There was a couple. And
Is the nail?
Does anybody know what video we're talking about? So this is a couple people with it, so we'll try and describe it, but I encourage you to go home and Google it. There's a couple talking, and in this case it was a man and a woman, right? And the woman is talking about how she's got these constant headaches, and you know, she just doesn't feel right, and all of her sweaters have holes in them. And as you zoom out, you realize that she's got a big nail sticking, you know, like a cartoon nail sticking out of her head. And the man kind of keeps trying to talk about how, well, maybe it's because of that nail. Maybe we need to fix this problem. And the point is sort of that he, or the point I took from it, was that she needed someone first to listen to the problems that she was having.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
So how do we, you know, first, I think, get more comfortable sort of expressing that ourselves, and then how do we, as you said, you know, sort of show up for other people and, like, be a sort of person who can help listen to somebody and then help them build resilience?
So I think when it comes to speaking up ourselves, Sheryl Sandberg and I spent about a year combing through all the research, and, you know, also she sadly really had to live it. She found that the most powerful thing that she did by far was actually to sort of acknowledge the elephant in the room. So I watched her say things like, I'm so glad that I'm with you. You're one of the few people I can talk to. And it immediately created this level of intimacy where, you know, the other person felt like, oh, I'm honored that, you know, you consider me one of those people that you're willing to open up to. You know, sometimes she would just hug someone a little tighter and it would signal that, you know, that she really needed to talk. But by far the most interesting thing she did was she brought up this problem. And she said, you know, I've noticed that a lot of people aren't saying anything and they're looking at me like I'm a ghost. And then they would, you know, they would say, oh, well, you know, I think it's because, and it opened the conversation up. And I think that this is one of the biggest things that I've learned about communication over the years as a psychologist, is we often forget to have the conversation about the conversation, the meta conversation. And it's true in so many domains. So, you know, when you want to give someone hard feedback, one of the most effective things you can do is you can say, I have some feedback that, you know, I wanted to give you. Are you interested in talking about that? And here's why I wanted to give it to you. And then, you know, they're much more open to the conversation. They bought into it. In negotiations, very often, I spent years teaching negotiations, and I'd have these, you know, these horrible bad cop, good cop situations where people struggled. They're like, I have to deal with someone who's unfriendly and unpleasant and maybe rude and selfish. What do I do? I say, like, let's have a conversation about how we're going to negotiate. And so I had a chance to actually try this out at a car dealership once. Because my student said, look, you have to test out all your principles. Like, you can't just say, here's what research says. You have to go do it and show us that you can do it, and then we'll do it. And so I went to lease a car, and, you know, I got what I knew was a ridiculous offer.
I have a question. So yeah. you were planning to lease the car already.
Yeah,
this wasn't
no,
just
yeah.
in service of the experiment.
I knew to lease a car anyway, and I took that as an opportunity to try this out. And, you know, the salesperson comes in with, you know, with an offer that's easily 30% higher than I think it should be. And I said, okay, this is a great time for a meta conversation. And I said, you know, I know what you're doing right now. There's this technique called anchoring, where you come in with an extreme first offer, and then you hope that will sway me. That's not what you're doing, is it? And just stunned silence. And I felt like I had to fill the silence. And I just said, you know, look, if that's how you want to play this, I'm happy to be that person too, but I would rather just, you know, sort of sit down and figure out what kind of profit you need to make and then agree on what a reasonable profit is. And he started laughing and he said, I knew I couldn't fool you. And then he came back with a reasonable offer. But that meta conversation was so helpful. And I think in the context of adversity, actually saying it's hard to talk about this. I've noticed that, that people, are really uncomfortable, and I don't want them to be uncomfortable, and here's what's going on. It's a great way to break the ice.
It seems, in my experience, obviously I come at this not as a psychologist per se, but as a fiction writer.
I don't know. I think fiction writers are great psychologists because you have to get inside people's heads that don't even exist.
I guess that's true. So it's like a meta psychology. Make up the person first and then get into their mind and figure out what they might be thinking if they actually existed. But, a lot of what I hear you saying is sort of that people are uncomfortable in some ways to not only acknowledge what's difficult, but almost afraid to try because they might get it wrong. Yeah. It's like, I might say the wrong thing. I remember reading one of the things Cheryl said in the book was that people wouldn't bring up her husband's death because they might think that it was like they didn't want to remind her.
And on this is crazy.
Well, on the one hand, I think that makes no sense. But on the other hand, I kind of get it because, so my father died soon after we left college, and people would sometimes not bring it up because I think they didn't want to remind me of something sad. And being the person in mourning, I would go, I know that happened. I didn't forget about it.
Not right? Possible to remind
not possible.
You. Right?
And yet at the same time, when I have friends who are struggling with anything, I have a similar thing where I'm like, well, I don't want to bring up an uncomfortable situation. And so it seems so natural. And it sounds like part of what you're saying is that you sometimes just have to push yourself over that sort of first barrier.
I think that's true. I think it also requires some perspective taking, though, that, the what people want when they're on the receiving end of, a conversation or comfort mm-hmm. is often really different from what people think they're going to, the other person's going to want. And I think we just forget to say, okay, if I were in this position, how would I be feeling? What would I be thinking? And of course, you can't ever imagine, right? And that's something we all say all the time. Like, I can't imagine. And that's true. But you can say, all right, I've been in a position where, people were comforting me about something in my life. And, I didn't want them to pretend it didn't exist. Now, of course, I didn't want them to force me to talk about it either. But it's really easy to say, look, I'm thinking of you. I know this is hard. And if you want to talk, I'm here. Let me know.
Yeah. So in addition to that, which is just sort of signaling that you're there to talk about things if they want to, what are some of the other important things we can do to show compassion to people who are facing adversity or really struggling with something or trying to figure out how they're going to move on?
So I touched really briefly this morning on the idea of showing up. Mm-hmm. And I think it's by far the most powerful thing that I've learned. I've just over and over again, said, hey, like, please let me know. And nobody ever lets me know. And it's gotten worse, since, my wife and I had kids and, people, I think, are more aware that I'm busier than I was before. And, nobody wants to be a burden or bother anyone else. And I've come away realizing that it's so important to show up and do something specific. And so a couple examples. One is we got an email from Hillary Weisfeld, who had read Option B. And then about a week later, she had her daughter's teacher had a four-year-old who was in the hospital with leukemia. She'd been diagnosed a while earlier, but then she showed up in the hospital with a dangerously low, I think, white blood cell count. And Hillary wanted to do something, but she just felt paralyzed in situations like that her whole life because, it's her daughter's teacher. She doesn't know her well. She doesn't know if it's appropriate. And she came out of reading the book and said, all right, I need to show up and offer something specific. So she went to the toy store, she bought a stuffed animal for the daughter, and then she showed up at the hospital and she emailed the teacher. And she said, I'm here with just a little gift. I wanted to let you know that I'm thinking of you. I can drop it off, at the front desk. And the teacher wrote back right away and said, please come up. And Hillary goes up to the room and the teacher's there with tears in her eyes that somebody, who's sort of an acquaintance was willing to be there and show up for her. And then Hillary writes her a few days later and says, I feel like you need a bad magazine subscription. Tell me what your favorites are, and if you don't, I'm just going to go rogue and send you one anyway. And the teacher a few months later said that Hillary was the single most helpful person in her life, that the way she showed up there was really something that she never would have expected. Like, she knew her close friends and some family members would be there. And I think the big message for me was you don't have to be friends since third grade to do something specific to show up for someone. The other thing that I think is really powerful here is I didn't realize until Cheryl lost Dave and until we really started talking with a lot of people who'd gone through hardship, how much havoc it wreaks on all domains of your life. And so in Cheryl's case, she, you know, obviously she was struggling as a parent, as a single parent for the first time, and, you know, really didn't appreciate what that was like until she lived it. But she also lost her confidence at work. Mm-hmm. She went back to the office and, you know, she could barely think, she could hardly focus, and, you know, she made what she thought were two completely incoherent points. And then she fell asleep in a meeting. And Mark Zuckerberg said to her, "That's okay, everyone sleeps in meetings." I'm like, "Really? I don't think that's true." And then he said, "You know, look," she said, I feel like I'm at 25%. And he said, "You know, I'd rather have 25% of you than none of you." And he worked with her to rebuild her confidence. And I think what was really important for her was to say, look, you know, the great thing about being at work was she wasn't reminded as often, right? She wouldn't hear the doorbell ring and expect it to be Dave. You know, she wouldn't sort of see the door open and expect that he was going to be there. And so it was a little bit of a relief, but she was struggling to feel like she could be effective. I never thought before that one of the best things that you can do for someone when they're facing personal hardship is help them rebuild their confidence in a different part of their life, work or volunteering or community. And this has had a big effect on me. So right after we finished writing the book, I had a colleague who lost her husband to cancer. And she had a young son, and before I never would have said anything because I didn't want to intrude. I didn't know her well. She's in my field, but we've probably met 6 or 7 times, and we email a few times a year. And I was thinking about this story, and so I emailed her, and I said, you know, what I would love to do is a few things. Number one, I wanted to find out how you're doing. Mm-hmm. Number two, I once wrote a recommendation letter for you, and I never shared it with you. And I'm attaching it here because I want you to know how great I think your work is and how important it is to our field. And she wrote back and she said her husband was a really big cheerleader of her work. And she's now doing this work sort of because she knows he would want her to continue. Never in a million years would it dawn on me to share that recommendation letter. And I felt like I had something to offer that I wouldn't have before. Yeah. That was a really long answer. I'm going to be shorter next time.
No, that was a really great answer. Because it says so much about the importance of, in some ways, sort of a small gesture or just saying to somebody, like, I see you. You know, you're there. And a lot of what I hear you saying, too, is that it doesn't have to be a big thing. It could be something as small as an email, or it could be something as you know, seemingly frivolous as a trashy magazine subscription, which is great. And I'm going to remember that the next time I have a friend who's just having a hard time for any reason.
I want to get your take on this, actually, because one of the things that I thought was incredible about Everything I Never Told You, your first novel, was how I felt like I knew the characters in it. And it was actually a little upsetting. It was kind of like how I felt after finishing Harry Potter when I realized that Hogwarts wasn't real. Like, I was so absorbed that I felt like...
Don't tell my kid that, because we're just reading the first one, and he's at this phase where he keeps saying, like, I don't think Hogwarts is real. Is it? And I'm like, I don't know how to answer this question yet. And so my husband has a Hogwarts t-shirt. And my son is like, I don't think that really came from Hogwarts. But did it? You know? I won't tell him that is apparently a struggle that continues into adulthood.
It does. Yeah. But you accomplished the same thing. You created these characters that I felt like I knew. And I think that there's a tremendous amount of empathy that requires. And so I would love to hear, like, how do you think about really getting to know a person, whether they're fictional or real?
For me, I think getting to know a fictional character, I tend to approach it basically the same way that I would get to know an actual person in real life, which is, you know, if you meet someone, the first things you talk about are kind of broad stroke things. Like, okay, you know, what's your name? Where'd you grow up? What do you do now? You know, what part of town do you live in? And then you start to kind of see more and more layers of the person. And so, you know, then maybe you start saying, okay, well, what do you like to do for fun when you're not working? Or, you know, what's your favorite movie and why do you like Love Actually so much? Or, you know...
It is my favorite movie. I can't believe you remembered that embarrassing fact.
I know a lot of embarrassing facts about you. You were the first person who actually made me watch Love Actually, as a matter of fact.
Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it was good. It was very cute. But you were so excited and you were so horrified that I hadn't seen it that I knew it was very important to you. So I'm glad that we shared that. But, you know, you start to get
to... I agreed to do this.
you're regretting asking me to come and talk
a little
to
bit.
You. But so this is what I mean, though, because you start to think things like, oh, well, that is not what I would have expected. So what is it about that? You know, which of the storylines really likes, you know, which one really grabs you? Or what is it about the movie? You know, do you like the part where the guy holds up the signs? And so you start to get a sense of what kind of person this might be, right? Like, you know, there's a certain part, like, oh, you love that, like, idealism, the romance of it or whatever. And then you start asking more questions, like, you know, okay, well, how do you relate to your family, or how do you did you get along with your parents? You know, are you close? You know, you start to get to know more and more of them, and I think that's how we get to know people, and that's how I try to get to know fictional characters, and I hope that's why a lot of people sort of felt seen by the book. And I was thinking of the emails that you said that you had sent to people. And some of the most meaningful emails that I get as a writer are people who write to me and say, we've never met. Maybe some of them say, you know, I'm not even Chinese, but I feel like you were writing about my family. And I try to respond to all of the emails that I get, even though I'm very slow at it, because I feel like one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I wanted people to feel seen and acknowledged. And I feel like that's one of the connections between our work, is that a lot of what you're saying is, you know, people sometimes just want to be noticed. It's like that small moment where, you know, you drop something on the ground and some stranger walking by picks it up, hands it to you, and walks away. You didn't need a lot from them, but you needed to know that somebody else was there. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a question, too, about, as you were talking about Cheryl going back to work and sort of rebuilding that confidence in that part of her life and how that helped her. But I feel like work is one of the places where it's really hard for a lot of people to show vulnerability, because we want to act like we've got it all together at work. And I think especially for women, that there's a lot of components to that, or at least I've felt that as a woman, that to show places where you're having trouble, or even sometimes to ask for help, is sometimes going to be seen by other people as a vulnerability or as a liability. And so how do we make it more acceptable for everybody, women especially, because we're at a women's conference, but men too, because men struggle with showing their vulnerability too. How do we make it more comfortable for them to talk about their struggles and to ask for help when they need it?
So I think the place to start for me on that is it's a big question of what kind of vulnerability you show.
Yeah.
So how many people watched the Oscars in 2014? How many people remember what happened in 2014? Okay.
Which one was that?
I remember it was the one where Jennifer Lawrence had kind of been, it was like post-Hunger Games, she was nominated, and she was walking down the red carpet, and she looked up to wave to someone, and she tripped and fell.
Okay.
And that was massively embarrassing. Everyone's been afraid, I've been afraid my whole life of tripping on stage, right? She did it on a 40 million person stage, but it was the second year in a row that she tripped and fallen at the Oscars. And I just thought she was going to be, you know, ridiculed for this. And the media coverage of it was amazing. It was, you know, Jennifer Lawrence masters her new falling routine. And people were cheering for her and celebrating, you know, her willingness to just own the mistake. And I thought that was so interesting. And it reminded me of this classic work in psychology on what's called the pratfall effect. Where in the original experiment, there were people who had taken like a trivia quiz. And when somebody aced all the questions and looked really smart, they weren't that well liked. People were like, you're kind of annoying. Don't be so competent. But then if they spilled coffee on themselves, they were liked 45% more. Because they looked human.
Yeah.
And, you know, people would say, oh, look, you're not perfect. I can relate to you. And, you know, I want you to be capable, but I also want you to be a real person. And I think that that's something we all get wrong about vulnerability. I don't think that the first kind of vulnerability anyone should show at work is the, I have no idea what I'm doing. You can't rely on me. Right? What you want to do is you want to establish your competence in one domain and then show vulnerability first in domains that have no bearing whatsoever on whether you're, you know, you're good at your job. And, you know, when I think about the examples of this, so you're not going to plan the Jennifer Lawrence one necessarily. But, you know, Abraham Lincoln was really gifted at this. And at one point, he was called two-faced in a debate. And he paused, and then he said something to the effect of, you call me two-faced? Do you really think if I had another face, I would choose to wear this one?
Yeah.
And that is pure genius, because you are not going to doubt him as a leader just because he's funny looking, right? You're gonna say, look, that's completely different. And so I think, obviously, what the domain is different for every person. But I think it's really worth asking, what are the things that you can be vulnerable on that are completely unrelated to your competence? And as you show those, it's low risk, and you see how people react to it, and then you figure out whether it's safe to go a little bit further. So my version of that is, I very often, when I meet somebody, I'll make a joke about how I don't have any hair. And they, you know, they either give me weird looks, like you just did,
When we were in college, you did have hair.
I did. and I sort of regret that because it was really bad hair. But I don't have the choice anymore. And, you know, very often I find that when I bring that up, people are a little bit more comfortable sort of realizing that I can make fun of myself. And then if that one doesn't work, I have a series of other sort of low-risk vulnerability options. Like I used to be a magician, and people then just think I'm really nerdy. So,
and this is a true fact, but not a bad thing. Well, I was actually going to ask you about being a magician.
Really?
I was, because so Adam used to be a magician, and in fact founded the Magicians Club at our college.
Co-founded
the Magicians Club.
Dorkiest thing I've ever done. My wife tells me there's a Family Guy line that magicians are at the very bottom of the hierarchy of entertainers, just above mimes.
What about clowns?
Oh, clowns. Actually, I have some data on this, believe it or not. I have a former student, Justin Berg, who studied Cirque du Soleil for a while, and he looked at which acts would take off when they did new performances, and it turned out that clowns are universally hated. No one likes clowns. So
I feel like we almost didn't need a study to prove that. But
that's so, probably true.
In all seriousness, what I was going to ask you about was that I know that you used to be a magician and that you used to do performances for all ages, but also sometimes you did some kid birthday parties and like bar mitzvahs and things like that. And so when you talk about showing vulnerabilities, I feel like teenagers are an audience where they will pounce on any vulnerability you have. But, you know, part of this show, I feel like, is you doing these amazing things, but also showing that you are still sort of a human being.
Trying.
And so I was curious if you had, when you were a magician, if there were times when you made mistakes and how you had to kind of pass off, sort of like Jennifer Lawrence falling up the stairs, how did you sort of pass off what you had made a mistake about and make it into sort of
human? So one of the things that I found most attractive about magic was, as an introvert who was terrified of public speaking, I felt like I was in total control. And I could plan sort of the script for how every trick was going to work, and it would go my way, except sometimes it didn't. And my favorite trick always was a card trick where I'd tell a story with the entire deck of cards, and I'd be shuffling them, and then I'd say something about, like there were a bunch of guys all named Jack, and four Jacks would come out. And then one day they didn't. And I have, I think if I counted correctly, 42 cards still left. And I don't know whether the rest of the trick is going to work or the whole trick is blown. And I just went on, and it was a complete fail. So I'd obviously made a horrible mistake, and I'm like, I'm never doing magic again. I'm retiring now. But I still had a show to finish. And so all I could think to do was say, look, sometimes magicians make mistakes, especially those of us who are not good enough to be doing anything other than, weddings. And I'm really sorry, but I'm going to try to make the rest of the show more entertaining than the thing that just happened. And then I had this insight, and I thought, you know what? Maybe I can work with this. And so I was going to do a card trick, and I thought, okay, I've already screwed up. There's nothing to lose from here. And so I deliberately embedded a mistake in my next trick. So I did the usual pick a card, and then I shuffled the deck, and then I held it up, and I said, is this your card? And the volunteer said, no. And I was like, are you sure? Are you serious? And then I looked at the audience, and I said, is this a joke? I really hope not, because I've already screwed up once. Like, please don't do this to me again. And they're like, no, really, that wasn't the card. And I said, all right, I give up. And I threw the deck in the air, and then I caught a card, and I said, was that your card? And that was the one. And what was so powerful about that was it left the audience wondering whether my first mistake was intentional. And so it was a great lesson for me that sometimes making a deliberate mistake after you make an accidental one can signal a little bit that you are in somewhat at least a little bit in control.
Yeah, it sounds too that like even with the Abraham Lincoln story, we're acknowledging Abraham Lincoln was a funny looking guy. In some ways, is acknowledging. Not a mistake, but a weak, a potential weakness,
yeah.
And making it something that can't be used against you anymore. That is then just something that we all accept and we understand.
Yeah, and I think I see this all the time in job interviews. So I had a student come into office hours yesterday, and she said, I'm trying to apply for these jobs. I come to interviews, people don't take me seriously as a 21-year-old, sort of privileged Ivy League student. And like, I don't know what to do with that. And another, she had a friend who came to office hours who said, oh, I know exactly how to deal with that. I've been doing it for years. And she said, what I do is I come in and say, look, I'm a Wharton student. You think that, you know, I'm going to know finance? I don't know a thing about finance. I haven't even taken a finance class. What I love is operations and supply chains. And then she had like a 1 minute soliloquy about why she thinks supply chains are the coolest thing on earth. And afterward, they didn't care that she had a finance weakness. And it reminded me of, there was a woman, Michelle Hansen, that I met a couple years ago at an event. And Michelle came up and said, I have a perfect strategy for explaining weaknesses in a way that doesn't make them weak. And it turned out that she'd been working in an early job in her early 20s. She saw this job posting. She was jazzed about it. It was at the Motley Fool. It was in financial services. And it required something like a decade of experience and a bunch of advanced tech qualifications she didn't have. And she wrote this brilliant cover letter. It said, I'm probably not the candidate you're looking for. I don't have 10 years of experience. I don't have these three certifications. But I'll tell you what I do have. I am a voracious learner. And the thing that I hear most often from the people who work with me is that I'm annoyingly proactive, and I love taking initiative. And if you're willing to give me a chance, I will promise you that you will not regret it. And they hired her, and she's been one of their star performers ever since. And I think too often we shy away from those moments because we don't want to put the weakness out there, because then we're shining a spotlight on it. When in fact, you know, it's just like calling out the elephant in the room. The elephant is already there. You might as well point it out yourself.
And then once you point it out, maybe everybody can talk about something else.
Yes, hopefully. Another great example of this that I loved is I grew up across the street from a wonderful writer, Jeff Zaslow, who's a dear family friend. And he was assigned to cover the, I think it was when Ann Landers retired from the Chicago Sun-Times. He was assigned to cover the story of the search for her replacement. And he woke up one morning and thought, I know what I'm gonna do. I'm going to apply for the job. And then I can cover what it's like to try to get the job, and it'll be a really unique angle. And he submitted his application, and they granted him an interview. He's like, wait, I don't know what to do now. He shows up, and he's 28 years old. He's 28 years old. And the interviewer says to him, why would a 28-year-old give advice? Why will people listen to you? What wisdom do you have to dispense? And Jeff looked right at the interviewer, and he said, look, I may be 28, but I have the wisdom of a 29-year-old. And he got the job. And I think those moments are so validating and so powerful, and I think that everybody should give that a shot.
Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about, I think, sort of bouncing back from sort of small things, like, you know, the magic trick that doesn't go well, or the job interview that doesn't quite pan out. One of the things that you and Cheryl talked about a lot is obviously big tragedies, dealing with like big, you know, deaths in the family, loss of a partner, really big problems, you know, escaping from terrible circumstances. How common is it for us to sort of be broken by tragedy versus bouncing back when we get to those big things?
I was really surprised by the answer to this, and I'd love to take questions right afterwards. Yeah. So. I kind of thought, how many people have heard of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD? Okay, about roughly, we think 15% of the population will go through that at some point in their lives based on a severe tragedy. How many of you have heard of post-traumatic growth?
I read your book.
So. Yeah, that's cheating. But over half of people experience that after some kind of tragedy. And I think this is an important discovery that a couple psychologists made back in the late 90s. They were interviewing parents who had lost spouses and children and, you know, just gone through some of the most horrifying things that anybody will ever experience. And they started asking them, you know, how has it changed your life? And they were taken aback when some of these parents said, well, here are the ways that my life has improved since. And I'm sorry, what? Like that's not even, you can't even say that, let alone think it. And the parents often took a step back and they said, look, I would give anything, including my own life, to undo this and, you know, to have this person I loved back. And I'm sadder and, you know, I miss this person dearly. But along with all of that, there are some positive changes that have come in my life. And the psychologist said, oh, that's post-traumatic growth. It's saying, look, it's not just possible to bounce back. You can also bounce forward. That does not mean your life is better overall, but it means that there are ways that you can grow from the worst things that happen to you. And I think we've all been through that, right? It's why Nietzsche wrote that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It doesn't always, but it can. And so when you break down post-traumatic growth, there are a few ways that people often grow through adversity. One is that they gain more perspective, and they say, look, I got through that. I can get through anything. A second is gratitude. They say, I appreciate life in a way that I didn't before. Third is deeper relationships. They say, look, it's brought me closer to people who have gone through something similar, or, you know, the people who have been there for me, I have a connection with them that I never would have had before. And then the last two are about seeing new possibilities and finding deeper meaning in life. That, you know, it oftentimes tragedy leads people to reflect on, you know, how am I spending my time? What do I want to do? What's my purpose? And, you know, the most common response to tragedy is people end up helping others more. But it's not just helping others generically. It's helping others in the ways that they themselves have suffered. And I think the reason for that is that when you do that, it not only gives your life meaning, it gives your suffering meaning. That, you know, maybe this didn't happen for a reason, but I can find a reason that, you know, I'm doing this work that might be so important. And so, you know, I think it's just good to know that that's possible, right? Because when you're in the wake of, you know, something really devastating in your life, it's impossible to see outside of that. And just to know, look, at some point I may end up stronger or more grateful because of that. You know, it's something maybe to have hope for.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful and optimistic note to end on. And thank you so much for the conversation. And should we open to questions?
Would love to.
So I think there are...
Come to a microphone.
Come to a microphone if you've got questions, and then I think then everybody will be able to hear it.
Celeste, while people are coming up to microphones, so your new book...
I thought I got away.
I know, you're trying. I'm not letting you. I was so excited when the Amazon page launched, and I saw that John Green, Fault in Your Stars, said it was his favorite book of the whole year. Can you give us a little bit of a soundbite on it?
About my book?
Yeah, of course.
I was not prepared for this. It's about, basically both of my novels deal, I think, with families that are sort of grappling with tragedies or with, you know, lacks of communication that kind of spiral outwards. And so it sort of has to do with the cracks in a family that sort of lead to a breakdown. So the new novel is about two families, one that lives in a sort of a beautiful, picturesque suburb, and a family who comes in from out of town, and they sort of get entangled with each other and cause some trouble for each other and have to sort of figure out how to move on from that.
And that's why you called it Little Fires Everywhere?
Yes, not based on the fires that are happening, literal and metaphorical now, yeah.
Got it. Thank you for indulging.
Yes, question.
So thank you for the really interesting talk. I've read your books, and they're all pretty different. And I'm curious, what inspires you to go down a research path, and what are you thinking about looking into next?
Ooh, I think when I sit down to write a book, usually what I do now is I try writing a blog post or an op-ed about it first, and then I see whether I still have ideas left. That's sort of the first test. If I'm struggling to get through 800 words, we're definitely not going to get to 50 or 100,000. The second thing that I try to do then is I take a moment to ask, do I have something to say about this topic that either hasn't been said before or that hasn't been articulated in this context before? And, you know, those are kind of on the later end. I think what provokes my curiosity the most is I think everything I've ever written about is about trying to recognize that there is not necessarily a trade-off between being a successful human being and also being a decent human being. And I didn't realize that actually until my second book came out, and one of the reviewers wrote that I'd written two books now that were both Trojan horses, that I was promising people more successful careers, but sort of what I was really writing about was how to live by your values, or be a person of generous character, be a person who champions, you know, who champions fighting injustice or ideas that need to be heard. And so I think that's the North Star when I pick a topic, right? I want to know, is this going to make people's lives better? Is it going to help them live by their principles without compromising their ability to achieve their own ambitions and goals? And so I can't imagine writing about something that doesn't fit in that. Where that takes me right now, I have no idea. I wrote, after two books in 2 years, I set a goal for 2017 to not write a book this year. And now that it's December, I'm definitely going to succeed at achieving that goal. What I've been doing instead is I feel like I haven't spent enough time learning in the past few years that, you know, I've been sharing the things I already know, and now I need to go back and reinvest in, you know, in learning new things. And so I've teamed up with the TED Talks team, and we're creating the first original TED podcast, which will come out in February. It's called Work Life. And I picked the 10 organizations that I think are most fascinating that can reimagine how we collaborate, how we create, and make our jobs better, and we're trying to figure out what we can all learn from them. So that's been the big focus, and it's given me an excuse not to write for a little while. Thank you for asking.
Thank you.
Do we have a microphone back there as well? Should we alternate?
Sure. Which one? I'm just going to go. Okay.
Go.
Hi, thank you. I find everything you're saying very informative. And I'm here with a few of my colleagues. We work for the Alzheimer's Association. So a lot of what we have to deal with is empathy and listening to people talk to us. We do a lot in fundraising. So it's a lot of people currently dealing with the disease and who have lost people to the disease. I'm in the current unique position of my mother's currently suffering with the disease as with early onset dementia. So a lot of what I see is, and I'm 26 years old, and a lot of people don't take me seriously because they see my age, they see me, they think, you don't know what I'm going through, you don't know my pain. Excuse me. And a lot of it is, there's a lot of self-entitlement that I see. And it's really disheartening to me because it's not something I ever want to come forward with, you know, unless it's absolutely necessary. But a lot of what I see in the tragedy of some of these people is self-entitlement. And I just was wondering if you could speak to that. And, you know, why do people resort or fall back on self-entitlement when it comes to dealing with tragedy?
Can I ask you what you mean by self-entitlement?
It's a lot of, you don't know my pain.
Got it.
Or, you know, I deserve this because of the pain I'm dealing with. I mean, this might be a silly example, but so I do fundraising. People think they deserve more incentive prizes because of the tragedy they're going through.
Got it.
Or people don't take what I say seriously, you know, just on a fundamental basis because I don't understand them. But yet, the moment I say, well, I do understand, you know, my mother's currently dealing with this disease, then it's, you know, they kind of take a step back and they're like, oh, that's such a shame, you're so young. And then they kind of, you know, fall into themselves because they kind of see they're not being maybe the nicest person and they think they're entitled to things because, quote unquote, people can't understand their pain.
Yeah.
And I deal with that within my own family. You know, I deal with my father who thinks that, you know, no one understands what he's going through, therefore his tantrums are warranted. And it's kind of this balancing act that I can't quite figure out, and maybe it's an insecurity thing with people, and that's what they resort to, but I struggle with it, to understand where people come with this idea that only they matter in this big spectrum of things. And I have a hard time being empathetic when it comes to a point.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, first of all. Celeste, if you have any thoughts, jump in. I guess my gut reaction here, I've spent a good chunk of the last 2 years reading every study I can find that speaks to that dynamic. And I think most of the time, what happens is this is a response from people who feel constantly ignored, not seen, to use your language, not understood and not heard. There's a writer, Tim Lawrence, who's been extremely eloquent on this, and he says that sometimes the most powerful thing you can say to someone, and do this proactively as opposed to reactively, in his advice, right? It's hard to recover from, you know, once somebody says you don't get it, then you have to undo the thing that they think you don't get. What he recommends is proactively saying, I acknowledge your pain. And there's a therapist, Megan Devine, who has a great follow-up on that. She says, look, some things can't be fixed. They can only be carried. And so what you can do is, you know, is say, look, I understand that you're in a lot of pain. And, you know, anything that I can do to ease that burden, you know, is really great. And I think the response of, you know, of you don't understand my pain is usually a wound of people saying over and over again, their pain's been ignored. It's not been heard. It's not been considered or taken seriously. I think the other thing that I've read that's been helpful at some level is to see that when people experience a tragedy, everyone grieves or suffers or copes in their own way in their own time. That doesn't mean, though, that there aren't some universals, right? So what I always try to do as a psychologist is to say, look, I understand that there are aspects of your experience that are completely unique, that no one will ever feel the same way that you have. At the same time, I also know that, you know, when we look at how people respond to caring for an ill parent, you know, X percent of them will experience the following kinds of emotions. And I want, you know, I understand that that's a common part of that experience, even though your experience of those emotions might be different. And so I think there's often an opportunity to find the common ground and say, look, even though there are parts of your experience that are sort of distinctive, there are also things that are universal about the suffering you're going through. And I want to, you know, I want to be able to speak to that too.
Hi, this is Kathleen Vilhaven. Thank you for your talk. My question is, given that you've been living and breathing this conversation, and how do you help other people, what do you find is the most difficult suggestions or advice that you have communicated to everyone else for you to apply yourself? Or what do you think is, maybe not so personally you, but what do you think is the most complicated piece that you're trying to communicate?
I think it's all hard, honestly. I think that, you know, a lot of what I've learned recently sort of goes against my instincts and my intuition. So it's, you know, I think it's hard to override a lot of it. I think the thing that's been hardest for me by far is to not try to cheer people up immediately. Because, you know, the first thing I think of is there's all this great research done right here in Boston that shows that people overestimate how long negative events will affect them. And, you know, sometimes you see this in really trivial cases. Like, you think being assigned to a bad college roommate is going to ruin your year, and it doesn't. Then you look at professors, and it turns out that they think not getting tenure is going to be much, you know, it's going to sort of plague them for 5 years, and they're going to be miserable, and they get over it much more quickly. But you also see it in some really serious cases, too. Like, people who go through horrible accidents, sometimes even experiencing paralysis, they bounce back much more quickly than they expect and than anyone else expects to, you know, some reasonable level of happiness on average. And so I know that, right? I know that everything feels like it's, you know, it's going to sort of stretch out into the future forever when you're in the thick of it. And yet, you know, I think there's a reason people so often say the cliche, time heals all wounds. And I want to tell people that because I know it's true. And I've watched it happen with people I know. I have, you know, really rigorous evidence that it's true. But sometimes it's the least helpful thing that you can say to someone. And I think that I've had a hard time, you know, sort of biting my tongue on that and not saying to people, it will get better, I promise you. Because you know what? I don't know when it will get better for them. And it's not my place to reassure them. On the flip side of that, there's a time when people really do need to hear that. And so, you know, the example that stands out for me is about 2.5 weeks after Cheryl lost Dave. I went out to do an event, and I ended up sitting down with her and her mom and some mutual friends. And she said, look, I don't believe I am ever going to get through this. And there, you know, I was torn, and then I realized that, number one, I think I'm her only psychologist friend. Number two, she loves data. And sometimes when you talk to people about, you know, what the research says, as soulless and sort of academic as it sounds, it shuts down a little bit of the emotional brain and it turns on their ability to reason a little bit. And so I thought, okay, maybe this is a time. And so I started walking her through these studies of how, you know, roughly 50% of people are out of acute grief in the first 6 months. You know, they're no longer feeling intrusive thoughts or extreme anxiety or shock. And, you know, that is a little bit reassuring. And, you know, it was one of the first moments where I saw her believe that she was going to get better. And I think that tightrope walk is the hardest thing, right? To know when to shut up and to know when to say, I know you are going to get through this.
Thank you.
Hi. So following up with the same question, even I have that. So one of my member in my family is going through sort of the same thing. And I talk to him every day and, you know, try to distract him in whatever ways, you know. The things I say always is like, you know, distract yourself while, you know, keep busy with your work or, you know, meet up, go set up with some friends and, you know, go out, learn something new. Maybe you want to change your career path or, you know, do what you wanted to do after a few years. Why don't you explore those options right now? But you know, it's not really encouraging him, and it's very difficult for him to concentrate, because every day, and you know, every day he goes to work and it's like he's just thinking about that and he's not able to even work or do anything. So the only thing I try to say is, you know, distract yourself, but I don't know if it's the right thing I'm saying, but I don't know how to even respond to that.
Yeah, this is really hard. I don't think there's ever a right thing. I think, you know, it's a matter of trying lots of different things and seeing if anything on the margin helps. I think that sometimes, you know, sending a card, writing a letter, people respond differently to, you know, a different mode of communication as opposed to conversation. That's always worth a try. There's research which we wrote about in the book, which shows that one of the best things that people can do is they can keep a journal. And there are a bunch of different kinds of journaling that turn out to, on average, help with recovery. That doesn't mean it works for everyone or it's always the right time to do it. But one is just journaling about the event or the emotions associated with it. There are a lot of studies showing that initially it makes you less happy because you end up sort of reliving some elements of the event. But that over time, you do a lot of work suppressing the event. And it actually not only boosts your happiness, it also increases your physical health. If you journal even a couple times for 15 or 20 minutes about a tragedy, that doesn't mean it's for everyone, but I think a lot of people find that helpful. There's also a lot of evidence that gratitude and joy journals are helpful. Even once a week, to write down three things that you're appreciative of has a measurable effect on happiness, and that's especially important for people who are not themselves in a good place. Joy works really well, too. The fascinating thing about keeping track of moments of joy is that even when your life is really bad, you can find a few moments of joy every week. And it becomes proof to yourself that you're not miserable all the time. It also becomes something that changes your outlook, because when something great happens, Cheryl said she had these moments where she'd say, "This is going to make the notebook." And then she was joyful about being joyful, that she had something. Meta joy is a great thing to experience. And I think sometimes those things are useful. I think, the other thing I would say, though, is that it's reasonable to resist any of that. I think a lot of people are familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work on stages of grief. And, the idea was people often went through denial and then anger and then bargaining and then eventually acceptance. And there's supposed to be five of them or maybe seven. And that turns out to be a total myth. They are not stages, they're states. You don't have to progress through one to get to the next one. It may also be that you think you're at acceptance, and then the waves of emotion come crashing back when you least expect it. And that's really common, and just knowing that's normal sometimes is helpful to people. I also think that there's a lot of pressure that people face to grapple with the topic at length. So, in the world of loss, people talk about grief work, and they're told that, you really haven't done enough to really think about this, to process your emotions. This has been studied for 40 years. There is no evidence whatsoever that grief work is helpful or necessary for anyone. It's helpful for some people. It hurts others. For others, it's completely irrelevant. And there are people who never really take a moment to reflect, and that's how they cope, and it's just fine. And so I think most of the time, one of the best things you can do for somebody else who's suffering is to just acknowledge the diversity of ways that you could respond and encourage them to try them all out and see what works for them.
Hi, I'd like to ask about resilience. And the reason is 6 months ago I took a newborn into my life who was born into a family who couldn't raise him, and he was also born blind. And my goal as an advocate, as a foster mother for him, is to build his muscle of resilience as he grows and becomes a person who sees himself as whole and strong and able, not as somebody who is blind and parentless. And I find that as people meet us or meet him and realize he's blind, without thinking, they let him for a moment be the recipient of victim mentality. Yeah. The, oh, poor baby, or things like that. And I try really hard to switch up that conversation into, he doesn't know sight. This is just, it's like me not having wings. I live without them just fine. And he's a really happy infant, and I want him to grow to be a really resilient, happy child. And I want to know if you have ideas of how to build that muscle.
Well, first of all, it's a really beautiful thing that you took him in. I think that deserves a round of applause. Let me make two suggestions. The first one is the most moving work of nonfiction I've read this year and maybe ever. Is a book called The Choice by Edith Eger. She was a Holocaust survivor. She's 90 years old today. And she went and became a clinical psychologist and said she was going to make her life's work about building resilience. And the book is about the choice to be a survivor as opposed to a victim. She spent a lot of time working with military veterans who had experienced PTSD. It was profound, and it is full of things that you can do immediately that I think are helpful. The research probably that struck me the most on parenting to build resilience is actually something we can apply to any kind of adversity, big or small. One of the biggest drivers of children's resilience is what sociologists call mattering. Mattering is the belief that other people notice you, care about you, and rely on you. And I think that most parents and caregivers get the first two right. Right, the parents are good at noticing. They make sure that their children are seen for the most part. They're good at caring too, right? That we know this is sort of a core part of the job. If you don't care, you probably should not have children. It's one piece of advice that comes up often in this research. Shockingly, right? But the third part, knowing that other people rely on you, we forget about that. And this is how I think we unwittingly turn children and adults too into victims, right? By trying to always be there for them, always do things for them. Part of knowing that you matter is knowing that you make a difference, right? That you have something to give, to share, to contribute to others. And so the biggest aha for me when I realized that was part of mattering was we need to rely on our kids too. We don't want to burden them. We don't want to stress them out. But I'll tell you how I've applied this in my own life, and I think it has lots of analogs for anyone who has children. After I started writing about this, I realized that I was doing a terrible job with this with our kids. So I went to our oldest, our 9-year-old daughter, and I said, I'm really nervous for a big presentation that I have to give. What should I do? And I asked for her advice. And she gave me a whole list of suggestions. She said, you should probably talk to a friend right beforehand who, you know, makes you feel sort of at ease. Or better yet, you invite a friend on stage. She said what you could also do is, you should make sure that you get a good night's sleep beforehand. And, you know, she actually came up with a list of really good ideas. And then a few weeks later, when she was nervous, instead of me just standing, on a pedestal and saying, here's my advice for you, I said, well, what advice do you give me? And what did you suggest? And she remembered. And I think there are a few things that happen when you ask your children for advice or when you ask anyone for advice. One is you show that you have confidence in them to handle their own issues. Two, you help them gain some distance and, really think about the problem through somebody else's shoes. And I think you've all experienced this. Psychologists call it Solomon's paradox. It's the idea that we're way better at giving advice to others than making decisions for ourselves. And so, sometimes the best thing you can do to help people figure out how to navigate a situation is invite them to help somebody else navigate that situation. And so I think that's a great way to help children feel that they matter and they're not victims. I think we have time for one more question. What do you think?
I think so.
What do you think? Hi. Good morning. Public speaking makes me nervous. That's a weakness I'll be open about. So I'm going to read the question from my phone. I'm really interested in this topic of resilience in organizations and company cultures. I think that's such interesting research. I was wondering if you do a lot of talks at other organizations, either in the U.S. or globally, and can you share insights from companies, maybe Facebook, who do resilience in organizations well, and where can that kind of culture start?
Sure. This has become one of my favorite topics. I think everyone needs resilience personally and professionally, right? Because you cannot live a life without encountering some kind of difficulty or adversity. In the work context, we think about failures, we think about big errors and mistakes, we think about economic recessions, we think about, your organization's mission being, disrupted or becoming irrelevant in some way. And you can make a very long list. I think that of all the things that I've learned about building resilience, the most important thing, and this is true for communities as well as workplaces, is it doesn't work that well if you try to build it after you're responding to a crisis. It works best if you build it beforehand. We see this in communities that go through natural disasters. The communities that bounce back the fastest and recover the most fully are the ones that had the strongest ties before the disaster. And so you can break down what does it mean to have a strong tie into three buckets. One is bonds, so the closeness of connections between people. Two is bridges. Different groups are connected, so they're not isolated. And then three is access to power, that the bonds and bridges that exist also connect you. In a city, it would be to local leaders. In a company, it would be senior leadership or the board. And I think we don't spend enough time thinking about, okay, part of our job here is to help people connect, closely together, but also to help them bridge so that different groups know each other and so that we lower power distance so that when something goes wrong, the people who are really on the ground doing the work have access to, to a leadership team. So a concrete example of this at Facebook,
Cheryl's been given feedback pretty much her whole career that she talks too much in meetings. And she knows she needs to overcorrect, because if she talks a little bit less, she feels like she's still going to be talking too much. And so one day she created a norm where she said, look, I'm going to come into my meeting, and I'm going to tell everyone what I'm working on and trying to get better at. And one of the things is, I talk too much in meetings. Please let me know if I'm doing too much of that. And she's putting it right out there so that everybody feels comfortable, you know, really voicing it to her. And then the other thing that happens is she says, look, here's the topic of the meeting. Here's the goal. And I'm going to talk last. And we're going to try Leader Speaks Last here. I want to go around the room and hear everybody's perspective and insight. And that way, I make sure I hear from all of you. And I'm also then in a more informed position than I was before. And those kinds of moments, right, where somebody walks into a room and says, I value everybody's opinion. I want to hear your ideas. And then reacts to them. Those everyday moments not only help you make better decisions, they're actually the stuff that resilience is made of. And so that's, I guess, a favorite example. Thank you all so much for being here today, and especially a huge thanks to Celeste for coming.